Well, good morning, everyone, and I'm just so delighted to see you all here. It's going to be a fun day, fun morning. And last night I got up here because our friend Diane Rehm said, "Susan, you know, just talk. You know, I'm tired of hearing my bio all this time." And so I came up here and tore up my speech and just talked. Well, I got a few more important things I want to make sure I cover, so I'm not going to tear it up, but I'm not going to give you her bio because it's in the little brochure that you have. So I'm taking half of your words, Diane. Thank you. So anyway, today is all about women's leadership and how women's voices are so crucial in our communities, our nation, and our world. And it's up to us to really change the world to be a better place for our having been here. So I challenge each and every one of you, men included, however, and I'm glad to see a few men here. And you know, I got around. You know, I count diversity, and so I usually count women because there's so few of us in most audiences. But today, you know, I'm counting men. You know, and there are a few. There's probably less than a dozen, but we're glad you're here. But anyway, it's up to us to change the world to be a better place. So, how is it that you're changing the world today? We have a wonderful lady here who, in her own, is a leader and is changing the world, doing her part as a thought leader in our nation. And to be prepared, I thought I'd go out and get a little bit of research on women in the media or women in broadcasting. And it's a sad thing, like in most areas, that women are less than 20% of the power seats, I would say. And we're working on that to bring about equality in sight by 2020, which is, if you don't know, the 100th anniversary of the right to vote. So I saw this interesting article about NPR. And I've always thought of NPR being a women-friendly organization. I mean, I hear women on the radio all the time, and I think see women in the station. I think of it as being very women-friendly. Well, I saw this article, which just grabbed me, and it was a recent article in 2012. The headline was, "How NPR Became a Hotbed for Female Journalists." And I thought, maybe that was a few years ago, but it was dated 2012. So one of the mentions was that women's voices are crucial to the media arena. They're crucial in positions of leadership because they impact the stories and the messages that are sent. And the result, the messages they convey are broader and better reflective of the general population. However, as I mentioned, women are vastly underrepresented, and specifically in what Diane would say, the power seats. And I love that word, the power seats, because that's where we need to be more represented. But that's in spite of the fact that since 1977, women have gotten more degrees in journalism than the men. In 2010, NPR had a woman CEO and a woman heading the news department. There were three women hosts in their top five rated shows. So that's pretty great. But let me just tell you a few specifics about the story because I think it relates to each and every one of us. The first was an interesting fact to me, that in the 1970s, there was no choice but to hire women. No choice but to hire women. And the reason was because the salaries were so low, men wouldn't take them. Can you imagine that? There were four women that were at the hotbed at this time. Nina Totenberg, Cokie Roberts, Linda Wertheimer, and Susan Stromberg, many of the names that we know. And Susan, actually, in 1972, was the first woman in the country to be an anchor woman for a news show, a national news show, 1972. That was pretty early. But here's the clincher. The culture was defined by these founding women. And mentoring was serious business. And I would only hope that we would take hold of this message, because here was an instance in this 1970s where women were indeed helping other women. And I'm sorry, but I don't know that we all do that as well today as they were doing it then. And I'd like to have all of you go away to say, how are you helping other women be the best they can be, to pull them up behind you so you can push yourself on up? Women helping women. Audie Cornish, 2 years ago, at the age of 32, said, I wouldn't be here if people didn't take an interest in my career. So how many people have you taken an interest in their career? It's important and it's impactful. And when Audie left NPR to cover Capitol Hill, she said, my first day I walked into a press room, all young reporters, white and men. She mentioned, this is not how we roll at NPR. So that's my story about NPR, a women-friendly organization, and we've got one of the best from NPR with us today. And I want to recommend Finding My Voice by Diane Rehm. It's a fabulous book, and I would encourage you all to have a run on Amazon. And it's a good read. It's just absolutely wonderful. So at this point, I would love to welcome my friend, Diane Rehm. Everybody says, did you know Diane before? And I said, heavens no. I just met her last night. But she's my friend. She's so personable. She loves everybody. But I'd like to welcome Diane to the stage, to welcome her to Indiana, to Purdue, to be here today celebrating the 90th anniversary of WBAA. Diane, we're so delighted to have you.
Thank you. What a lovely introduction Susan just gave me, and I want to thank you, Susan, for throwing away the bio and just doing it the way you felt, because the way we feel as women and as men can indeed change the world. Susan started out talking about women's voices. And before we go any further, because I know several of you in this audience, both men and women whom I met last night and have met here this morning, have spasmodic dysphonia, as I have. I have what's called the adductor, adductor form. The abductor is a totally different version. The two are both affecting the vocal cords. The adductor, which I have, brings the vocal cords together inappropriately, so they clamp down, and what you get is an kind of sound. With the abductor, the vocal cords are so far apart that they cannot come together to create sound. The abductor is harder to treat. What some doctors do is to inject collagen into those vocal cords to try to bring them closer together. With the adductor, I receive Botox injections directly into the vocal cords periodically. And what the Botox does, I assure you, It has nothing to do with cosmetically treating my wrinkles. And I still have lots of wrinkles up here, which I'll never touch. They're a part of my wonderful aging process. The Botox relaxes those vocal cords temporarily so that I'm off the air for a little while. And then during that period, I'm sort of whispering. And the first time I had that injection, I whispered for 2 weeks. And so in order to hear me, my husband, now of 52 years, would put his ear right next to my mouth so that he could hear me. He said it was the most intimate time in our marriage. So I do get those injections periodically, and I'm very grateful that management and listeners are tolerant, because it's tough stuff to go through. The first time I got that injection, I was off the air for 4 months. I had tried for 6 years to find out what was the matter with my voice. And doctors kept telling me it was all in my head. Many of you have experienced that. It happens. But finally, at Johns Hopkins, in 1 hour, a neurologist and an otolaryngologist explained what I had. And I knew what I had, because I'm not going to just sit back and allow this to happen. I had done my own research. I kept asking, do I have SD? And they kept saying, no, you don't. And here I go to Johns Hopkins, and in 1 hour, I am diagnosed, I am treated, and that's the story. Now, I had an injection in early April. It was the first one I had had since September of 2010. So it's getting better with the help of exercises I'm doing and voice coaching I'm doing via Skype with a voice coach out in Los Angeles, who you might be interested to know has been working with Lisa Marie Presley on her latest album, which has just been released. Unfortunately, I'm not earning the same kind of dollars that Lisa Marie Presley is, but we both have voices in part because of Gary Katona. Men have experienced the same problem, but just let me tell you that spasmodic dysphonia happens to women much more frequently over the age of 55. Some believe that it's related to hormonal changes. Who knows? I hope they'll keep working to find a cure. Having said all that, I do want to be among those to congratulate WBAA for 90 years on the air. Huge applause. And an absolutely wonderful public radio station that sends out messages of hope, of encouragement, of good news, of good conversation around the Indiana area. And yes, Susan, you're right. back in 1970, when NPR was first getting off the ground, Susan Stamberg was at the time the manager of my station, WAMU. In fact, there were only two paid people at the station at the time. And at one point, Susan herself tells the story on herself that she was the weather girl. And at one point, she walked into the studio and realized she had forgotten to bring the weather. And she made it up. She loves to tell that story. She's so great. But Cokie came in shortly thereafter, encouraged to come on after she and her husband, Steve Roberts, who had been a New York Times reporter who had been stationed in Greece for several years. And when Cokie came with Steve back to this country, she went to NPR, and with the help of Nina Totenberg and Linda Wertheimer and Susan Stamberg came aboard. So when I walked in the door as a volunteer in 1973, it never occurred to me to worry about women in broadcasting. It just never occurred to me to think that a woman couldn't be on the air. I had been raised with all the soap operas. We didn't have a television set in our home until I was ready to graduate from high school. So I grew up with radio, all the soap operas, all the Saturday morning programs like Let's Pretend, The Green Hornet, The Shadow, The Romance of Stella Dallas, Our Gal Sunday, all those wonderful programs. So I heard women's voices on the air, and it just never occurred to me that in broadcasting there was any separation or distinction or a minority or a majority. And I must say, though I have been at WAMU for these 32 years since I took the show in 1979 and have had both male and female managers, they all make mistakes. Whether they're male or whether they're female. NPR has just had a huge shakeup. We had Vivian Schiller, who was at NPR, who had come from the New York Times. Everybody heralded her. And then perhaps you all know about the scandal where a young fundraiser sat in a very upscale restaurant and unbeknownst to him was taped making disparaging remarks about some minority groups and subsequently was fired. And then it worked its way up the chain and Vivian Schiller was fired, as well as the news director after an encounter with Juan Williams. You all know that story as well. So, you know, men and women make mistakes. And that is the problem, I would say, with management generally, that management gets too far ahead of, too separated from the people they manage. one of the complaints I have at our station, which when I began had about 5 paid people, we now have about 130, is that communication is done by email. Important communication is done by email. I don't think that helps for cohesiveness. I don't think it helps for the kind of creation of a strong team effort that Susan was talking about. We all need to be together in some way, in some form, in order to help each other. And I send that message out to you orally, verbally, because that's the way you help people. I think that doing the show each day for 2 hours has helped me to hear from people around the country to understand the difficulties that people are going through right now in this time of real concern about where our country is headed. I think we've got lots of problems, no matter who gets into the White House in the fall. It's going to be tough sledding ahead. I was looking at some of the cartoons this morning on the op-ed page in USA Today. One of them has us looking very much like Greece. I don't think that's going to be the case, but I think there are a lot of people who are worried. You know, where are we headed? Where I am headed is to more public radio, more concern that public radio should grow and succeed. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that unfortunately NPR finds itself once again having to draw on funds from the CROC money that was given to it, $225 million, to pay salaries, to meet a deficit. And that creates great concern for people who are devoted listeners to NPR. We've also seen for the first time in a decade the numbers of listeners to NPR go down by 1 million. Thankfully, not affecting my program, but affecting NPR overall. And that is something that I'm sure NPR will be addressing, and addressing very, very carefully. I want to talk for just a moment about the idea of how women at whatever age move ahead. As I told everyone last night, I was a homemaker for 14 years. I had married my husband, had our first son, our first child, 9 months afterwards. My aunts and uncles were all watching very carefully. Our daughter was born 3.5 years later, and I stayed home with them for 14 years, doing all the carpooling, doing all the taking them to not only nursery school, but activities, ballet, which my daughter hated, soccer for our son, football for our son, doing all the kinds of things parents have to do. Only young people today have 10 times more to do than I did back then, because kids are so much more involved in more activities these days. But when our son turned 14, I sort of began to wonder what I would do with the rest of my life. It was clear that he was not going to be needing me for much longer, and Jenny would not either. So I began thinking about what was next and took a course called New Horizons for Women at GW, and I have to tell you, I was scared to death to walk onto that campus at GW because I had never been to college. My mother and father came here from the Middle East, my father from Beirut, Lebanon, my mother from Alexandria, Egypt. Neither believed in education beyond high school for girls. So when I walked onto that campus at GW, I thought, ugh, they know. They know. It's here on my head, and they know. Well, indeed, what happened, as I mentioned last night, was that those with PhDs who were also wondering about their own futures were put into a classroom on the top floor, those with masters, the next floor, those with bachelor's, the first floor, and those of us without a degree were put into the basement. And I promise you, after I got where I got, I went back and told them they ought to change that pretty quickly, and they have. At that course, which was all women, there were about 20 of us, people said to me, you ought to be in broadcasting. Why? I to this day do not know. But they said it to me, and I said, you know, you guys are really nice, but you're crazy. I have no background, I have no experience, except I had been on the stage since I was 5 years old, doing plays, memorizing was no problem, acting outside myself was no problem. So maybe I talked a lot, maybe I used my hands a lot, who knows. 1 week after I finished that course, a friend mentioned to me that she was doing volunteer work at WAMU. If you could have seen me at that moment, you would have seen a light bulb go on over my head. And I said, oh, where is this? At American University, 5 minutes from my home. So I said to her, do you think they could use any more volunteers? She said, I don't know, I'll ask. I did show up as a volunteer a week later, and the host was out sick. And the manager said to me that she, the manager, had to be the host that day, and would I please come into the studio with her? So my first day at WAMU, I went into the studio, sat at the table with microphones and a guest. For 90 minutes, we talked to a representative of the Dairy Council. And I asked questions because I asked questions. When I was a stay-at-home mom and would accompany my husband, who had a high place in the Kennedy Johnson administration, you know, people would say to me, well, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a homemaker. But I quickly learned that if I simply stopped there, they would go the other way. So what I began doing was asking them questions about what they did and learning from them about the world, as we do every single day, try to learn about each other. It's a great way, no matter what you do or don't do, to open a conversation. The most boring dinner parties I've attended have been those where I ask one question and a guy goes on for 20 minutes. The most interesting dinner parties I have been to have been those where people are willing to engage. I ask a question, I get a question after, and then a conversation, a real conversation begins, which is why Susan stood up here and said, she's my friend. Last night, she and I talked probably for an hour asking each other questions. And it is the way you learn about other people. And of course, in my family, that Arab household, which was so strict and so firm, I, as a child, was not permitted to ask questions. The law was laid down. There were no opportunities to say why. So I've been making up for it ever since. And now what I'd like to do is to hear from you. Let us now have a conversation. Let's open the phones and hear your thoughts, your questions, your comments. I'd love to talk with you. Please, don't be bashful. The lines are open. There are microphones that will come to you if you have a question.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Please tell us your name.
My name's Joanne Evers, and I'm from West Lafayette, and good. A supporter of WBAA. So
good. Great.
My question is, how do you screen your questions? I know you have someone special. They always say so-and-so answers the phones. And then you have your tweets and your emails and everything. How are those screened to get them on your show?
All right. Let me tell you that screening is not really a word we use to describe how those callers get on. Let me tell you why. We have seated with the engineer on the other side of the glass a phone answerer. It was for a long time Dori Annisman, whose name I'm sure you know, and we have a young woman named Natalie who is now with us. She has in front of her not only the telephones, but a computer. And on that computer, she takes the call. She takes the name of the person, where they're from, and then five words about what they want to talk about. Inside the studio, I have a duplicate computer. So what goes up on her screen comes up on my screen. If a caller from what she has put up there has a totally irrelevant question. If we're talking about, for example, the medicinal use of marijuana, and somebody is calling and saying, I want to legalize all drugs, I will point to her, say, line two, and that kind of screening does take place. But what normally happens is that from those five words that she has put up on the screen, I am trying my darndest to work that caller in at the appropriate moment in the conversation relative to what that caller wants to say. So what you are getting, I hope, is from the top of the hour all the way around, a fullness of a conversation, one that is not disjointed, one that does not go off on irrelevant tangents, but rather one that makes sense and gives you a better idea of the subject matter we're talking about. But screening is not a word I use. I go like that, but that's not screening. Yes, please.
It's not about a topic, but I would be interested in hearing you define the most interesting person you've ever interviewed and why. Why was that person so fascinating?
If I may, let me turn your question around and talk to you about the most difficult person I've ever interviewed. Last night I talked about Fred Rogers, and I know many of you heard that story last night. Let me tell you a little about Tom Clancy. Does that name ring a bell? He is a man who has made probably millions of dollars on his books. And the first time he came into, the first and only time, I might add, he came into our studios. I came out at the 11 o'clock hour between the 2 hours to greet him. He had on his dark aviator glasses. He's an imposing guy. He's big. And I put out my hand, said, how do you do, Mr. Clancy? It's so good to have you here. He did not put out his hand, which I thought was rather odd. Maybe he had some concerns about germ warfare or whatever. So I expected him really to, once we got into the studio, which didn't have very much light coming in, I expected him to take off those glasses. Instead, he sat down at the table, kept his glasses on, and put his hand up on the table like that. So it was clear Tom Clancy was sort of uncomfortable about being there. And I'm thinking, this is going to be interesting. I had read his book thoroughly. And so I had really some good questions, not superficial about his writing or his wealth, but really from the heart of the book. So I posed the first question. And the answer was, yep. And I thought, well, let's try again. Came up with another, what I thought was a good question, which would give him a wide open opportunity to respond. His second answer, nope. Still, this way. So I'm thinking, I've got two choices here. I can either say, Mr. Clancy, it's clear you prefer not to be here, and frankly, this is awkward. So why don't you just leave, and I'll open the phones and talk to listeners, or maybe he's got some problem with me. Maybe he doesn't like women, maybe he's got, you know, divorce going on, whatever. So I opted instead to open the phones. Luckily, first caller is a man who starts out by saying, Mr. Clancy, we love your books, but you sure are being arrogant with our Diane. At which point he threw his glasses on the table and said, oh no, we're having a wonderful time, aren't we? And the fellow on the phone says, it sure doesn't sound that way to us, Mr. Clancy. From then on, he was a pussycat. His publicist has called, I cannot tell you how many times in the subsequent books he's written, and I've just said, no, thank you. He did subsequently divorce his wife after he made all that money. So who knows what was behind it, but it was a long hour. Next question, please.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Gruenbaum. I'm from the anthropology department here at Purdue.
Oh, good.
One of the things that I've noticed with my students, I think of many of us involved in education would love to hear your ideas about this, is that our students are so involved in information in so many different forms that sometimes they don't stop to read a book thoroughly, or they don't have time to really get deep into subject matter. And yet we have so much that needs to be communicated. I wonder if you have some advice about how to ride this wave of all this information that our students are trying to navigate to get the important messages about the things that need to be done in society across, and try to give them inspiration to not be despairing about all the things they hear.
Thank you for the question. In fact, that was the subject of my commencement speech at Shepherd University in West Virginia last week, and will be the subject of my commencement speech at George Washington University's School of Public Health tomorrow. I think that we have been caught up in a plethora of sources of information. And to my mind, the greatest detriment to that is relational, that we have been caught up, and especially young people have been caught up in this concentration on always being focused on the next thing, on the next message, on the next tweet, on the next posting on Facebook. And God knows Mark Zuckerberg is going to make billions of dollars today, but I'm going to wait. I think we are losing, in a sense, and I don't mean to make this sound devastating, but we are losing a portion of our real humanity by forgetting the importance of conversation. Now, clearly, I'm biased. Conversation is what I believe enriches life. But young people are focusing more on the expansion of a field and the connection beyond themselves, that they are forgetting how important it is to sit and talk and to really engage. I can remember that our children came to the dinner table each and every night. No television, no radio, no books, just conversation. It was the most important time of the day for our family, and still is. When we sit down to dinner, it's just my husband and me now, and perhaps this is why it's so important to me. My husband has Parkinson's with Lewy body syndrome, and for those of you who know Parkinson's, you know that that means a drifting away. And therefore, the conversation is much quieter. There are fewer words. There is less exchange about a New Yorker article he's read or a movie we've seen, because we haven't seen a movie outside the apartment in probably 2 years. Conversation creates meaning and depth. Conversation is what keeps us human, is what keeps us relating with each other. And that's my worry for these young people, that they are so focused on these gadgets and so focused on the illusory connection that these gadgets provide, that they will forget how important it is to relate on a human level.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for being here today. My name is Angela Tamer. I'm the president for the Young Professionals Organization in town, Tippy Connect. And I would like to ask if you could please give us a takeaway on how women in our organization can achieve our dreams. I would greatly appreciate it.
I think that women need to, number one, follow a passion. When I started out, long after I had been at WAMU as a volunteer, I was there for 10 months as a volunteer, learning about radio. The person who had the one paid position left because she was pregnant. I was in the right place at the right time. All of my friends said to me, "Why are you volunteering? Why aren't you being paid?" And my answer was and remains, I was learning. I think any opportunity to learn is a gateway to indicate to you whether you love that volunteer work and want to pursue it more, and whether you are willing to put in the time and effort to pursue that dream. I can tell you from my own experience, having started in 73, stayed with the station until 75 as a part-time employee, then left to do some television, which I hated, then pounded the pavements for a year because I was out of work. And then on the same week, I was called by the Associated Press Radio Network and Physicians Radio Network to part-time jobs that meant getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to set my microphone before the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which was then HEW, carrying equipment. My shoulders got so bad, I could hardly lift them. In other words, it doesn't happen easily. You gotta work your bottom off. And you have to be willing to do that. Too many young people, I fear, have begun with dreams, but are not yet realizing how much effort they have to put into the work part, the self-training part, the relationship part, in order to achieve those dreams. So what I am saying is, think about what you'd like to do. Think about 5 things you'd like to do. Settle on 1 and follow it as hard as you can, but be willing to work as long as you can. I used to come home at 8:30 at night, having started out at 5 o'clock in the morning. And my husband finally said to me, "This can't go on." But it did. And here I am, and here we are, and I want to thank you all so much for being here. Please support WBAA, support public radio, do everything you can, donate generously, and be there to do the volunteer work. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.